Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. On April the 6th, Elaine Bean, staff writer for DelmarvaNow.com, wrote a two-part series covering agricultural regulations and their impacts on Worcester County. This week on Soundbites, we bring the story to life, hearing the voices of many of those people who were interviewed for that article and whose comments also appeared there. So how do agricultural and environmental laws in Maryland affect the economy and the ecology of the Eastern Shore? Well, we'll hear from the farmers, government officials, and environmental activists who are part of this DelmarvaNow.com article to wrestle with this question. We're about to talk with Kathy Phillips, who is the Assateague Coast Keeper and on-the-water advocate who patrols and protects the Maryland and Northern Virginia Eastern Shore coastal bays, and she's joined us many times in the past. Kathy, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Well, it's nice to be back with you, Mark. Thanks.
It was an interesting article, and I just want to expand on your take that you were quoted on in the article. One of the piece you were quoted directly on had to do with the place of the poultry industry in the entire economic sphere picture in Maryland, and there's a real difference. People say this is like one of the great economic engines of Maryland. You have a kind of a different perspective.
From my perspective, I'm speaking for the water, and I'm down here in the coastal bays, and our coastal bays are impaired. They're in trouble. Chincoteague Bay is especially, you know, what used to be the most pristine of all of our coastal bays' waters down here over the last 10 years has just been declining and declining. The Maryland Coastal Bays Program's report card that comes out each year continues to show minute or no improvement at all to some of our waterways. And there's many reasons for that, but especially for Chincoteague Bay, a good part of that is the fact that that bay gets the greatest impact from agriculture. We have to look at all this. I realize for some people it's uncomfortable. They don't want to bring farming into it. It's so much easier to blame, a big outfall pipe that is spewing, industrial toxins into the water. That's much easier to deal with and to have to blame. But the reality is that agriculture is still, for the Chesapeake Bay especially, and in some respects down here in the coastal bays, a contributor of pollution to the waterways, and it has to be dealt with. Clean water means a healthy watershed, and here in the coastal bays, a healthy watershed means a healthy resort industry. So when you go to the state of Maryland's Department of Business and Economic Development website, and you start looking at the gross domestic product numbers for the state of Maryland, I know that I keep hearing our politicians and obviously the poultry industry always talking about how poultry is the driving force for the state of Maryland. I see it from a different perspective because I see the millions of people that come down here to fish on our waterways and to swim and to enjoy what we have to offer down here, which is totally dependent on clean water.
So when we look at finding, like the other people who said in this piece, we're trying to find the most common denominator to bring people together, Is that pie in the sky? Can that happen? I mean, are these industries just overregulated? Is it hurting farmers? I mean, is there another way out of this other than what we see?
I think that as long as we have a Farm Bureau and we have trade industry organizations that obviously it's their job to continue to build up their industry and to, you know, make it appear as important as possible. You know, the past 3 years has shown how strong they are in creating the messages that they want out there, through a pretty well-funded PR campaign. So as long as that is the perspective that is constantly reflected in our local media down here, you're going to continue to have farmers who feel like they're put upon. You're going to have a general public that, you know, is asking the same question that you just asked me. I think if we could stop with the rhetoric and really take a good look at things, I think that people will begin to see that this is not really an overregulated industry. In fact, it's probably the most unregulated industry in the state. Now, from a grower's perspective, from a farmer's perspective, despite what they may think about me, I get it. I understand. I'm not really talking about them. I'm talking about, you know, the fact that we have rules and regulations that are supposed to help clean up the water that were put in place. Most of them are voluntary for the farming industry down here, but they're doing it. They're trying to do what they can do. But the point is, it's obviously not good enough. How we make these things work better, I think, comes down to the fact that we need to have more monitoring of, you know, we've got rules and regulations in place, but they pretty much, it's just a paper trail. It's just something put on paper and it's filed away. It's never really followed up on to find out, is this really working or not? Maybe it's not working.
We're about now to talk to Royden N. Powell III, who appeared in this article as well. He is Assistant Secretary for Resource Conservation at the Maryland Department of Agriculture. And Royden Powell, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
There are arguments on both sides saying that when you look at this, that that the bay and water quality still has a long way to go, and others will argue that it is getting better, and that you're going to have to give it a much longer time before we know. Some people are saying you have to make kind of tougher restrictions now on phosphorus, on nutrient runoff. Others saying you're going to have to wait 10 years or so when we see how this groundwater clears up. I mean, where do you fit into all that?
I think it's a combination of those things. I mean, there are technologies that have been demonstrated, you know, both in a research setting as well as on the farm, that are effective in improving water quality. And whether that means reducing erosion or whether that's a better way to manage animal waste, and on Delmarva that generally means poultry litter,
right,
then we need to, you know, be applying those technologies and do it in a way that's effective. So historically our approach has been to reach out to the ag community and provide them, you know, technical assistance, recommendations on improving farm management. More recently, that's going more in a regulatory vein because we just need to go farther in certain situations. There are certain sciences that we know, University of Maryland, for example, is telling us regarding phosphorus management. We're learning more about how phosphorus moves on the landscape. And in the Delmarva Peninsula, that means groundwater issues. So we're adopting a new phosphorus management tool. That's our latest understanding, you know, of the science on phosphorus. So as we learn more, as we need to do more, you know, we're making those decisions to have those desired outcomes.
So what is it where do you see? Do you see any kind of shortcomings in what we're doing now, things we need to change to make this work in a better way?
One of the things that we built into the latest set of regulations that people are talking about today, we adopted a set of regulations last October. And within that, new requirements is a phased approach. There are some things that are effective immediately, and there are other things that are phased in over time. With this phased approach and the additional resources that, you know, that we're putting on the table, recognizing their economic considerations, through that combined approach, we're on track and scheduling to meet these goals over time. The fact that, in fact, just the way phosphorus levels change in the soil, science tells us that those levels come down very, very slowly. So people need to recognize that science and, in essence, in one sense, be patient and allow these new regulations as well as these new risk management tools to regulate the use of those materials on the land and then over time be able to measure those changes in soil phosphorus.
So so where would you say that you think we are at the moment in terms of reaching the goals we're talking about? I mean, I think that, especially in terms of regulation, I mean, do you think the industry itself is overregulated, underregulated, or it sounds like the three bears are regulated enough, but where do you see it?
I think we've taken a combination of approaches, and regulation is one aspect of this approach. So historically, we've focused on technical assistance. The second leg of that is financial assistance, recognizing economic impacts. And the third leg of the stool is the addition of additional regulatory requirements to move the ball down the field. So I think it's a balanced approach in terms of using those three components to meet these environmental objectives.
Royden Powell III, he's Assistant Secretary for Resource Conservation at the Maryland Department of Agriculture. And Royden, thank you so much. We look forward to talking to you again.
Okay, Mark, thanks for the opportunity.
We're about to talk to Lee Richardson, who is a poultry, corn, and soy farmer in Willards, Maryland, who also appeared in this article. And Lee, welcome. Good to have you back with us again.
Nice to hear from you again.
So Lee, talk a bit about this whole article was around the issue of regulation and, of course, runoff and things like that. But starting from the top, when it comes to regulation, I mean, tell me where you think we are in Maryland when it comes to regulating farming operations, farm runoff, manure issues. I mean, go ahead.
As far as the state of Maryland goes, we seem to be one of the most restricted or regulated farming communities in all the state. We're right there near the top, if not the top. I talk to farmers in other states, and they're always asking, you know, what's happening here, because they figure that's what's coming to them next. We're always ahead. So, you know, it's a lot, you know, we seem to be fighting it constantly. You know, and a lot of it's the population, you know, you're right on the edge of Baltimore, Washington, and everything, and population, a lot less farmers and a lot more just people. So, you know, we get a lot of regulations because there's a lot of people that don't understand agriculture and try to make the rules. And they don't know anything about agriculture. I think that's our biggest problem. It's not just that there is regulations, but it's regulations being made by people that never even stepped on a farm. So it gets very aggravating when they try to change things when we're sitting here saying, well, that's not going to help the environment or anybody. It's more paperwork, if anything, and makes records, but it's not doing a bit of good for the greater good.
So what is it specifically? Just curious. We've talked about this before in the past, but what is it about the regulations as they exist that are the most burdensome or troublesome for you?
Well, I think in the near future, the worst one for me is going to be is they keep doing everything they can to make it so we can't use any manure whatsoever. And, you know, the manure, they make manure out to be a bad thing. Well, if I don't use chicken manure, I'm going to use commercial fertilizer to make the crop, because I have to have certain nutrients. And I understand that, you know, the manure has extra phosphorus that we're not using up. But at the same time, it's a very slow-release phosphorus where the commercial fertilizer nitrogen that I'm going to use that I wouldn't be getting in my chicken manure now is going to be a lot faster release, more potential to leach, you know, if the weather conditions don't go the right direction. So, you know, our concern is, you know, is it going to be worse for the environment going to commercial fertilizers? The other thing is we're talking a tremendous amount of difference in cost. Manure is not free, don't get me wrong. I mean, we pay for our manure, and it costs a lot to spread it and stuff like that. But the commercial fertilizer overwhelmingly exceeds that cost. So it's certainly going to be a problem in the future as far as making ends meet, you know, especially when grain prices are starting to fall again. It has a, you know, some big concerns. concern for farmers is whether they're going to make, be able to make it without chicken manure, you know, at all. I mean, it helps, it's nice to have it at least as a supplement. But, you know, they're looking right now, the new regulation coming out this year is going to restrict, pretty much restrict that area 100%.
You're talking about the grain prices are dropping.
They've slowly been falling here the last year. So we're not rock bottom or anything like that. Don't get me wrong, but it has the potential to be pretty low compared to years past.
So yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was interested in that. I remember interviewing some of the farmers on the shore who have switched over to organic. And it's interesting how in your world it's different. In their world, they can almost demand their price.
Right. Right. Because there's such a shortage of organic raised corn. Some stuff to go through to get to that point. So it costs more to raise it for one thing. But at the same time, they can pretty much set their price because there's a lot of people looking for it and there's not enough out there for them. If anything, there's a shortage of it. So, you know, that's why some have actually switched trying to grow a few acres of it. We've not gone that direction. It changes up our total operation to a certain degree, and it's a lot more intensive. The other thing is it does better with conventional land, which means you have to till your land up. We're strictly no-till to try to keep our soil intact. And it's a little harder to control the weeds in no-till. Not impossible, but it's a totally different program. You can't use chemicals and stuff like that for organic. A lot of them have switched to conventionals that are cultivated, but at the same time, you worry about erosion and soil loss from wind and everything else at that point. So it's a big change. We take pride in our no-till over the last 20 years and feel like, you know, that we've done a lot for the environment by just going no-till. You know, we don't have the soil loss that we used to have and stuff like that. I mean, we rarely clean out our ditches now except for occasional blowout of, you know, a major rain or something caused a washout. But as far as cleaning our ditches out, we don't have to do it. It used to be every 2 or 3 years we had to clean ditches out, you know, to keep it flowing. But they seem to maintain now because of we're not having that soil movement to plug them up.
So you mentioned no-till. You mentioned the article for the Delmarva, delmarvanow.com. You mentioned turbo-till. Process in your article. So talk about you just mentioned no-till. So what is turbo-till?
Turbo-till is it's actually a tillage tool that we pull behind the tractor, but what it does is what's called vertical tillage. And vertical tillage is you're going in and slicing to the ground and kind of cutting the ground open, but you're not tilling what's there. So when you're doing it in the spring, we do it in the spring to incorporate our manure, and it kind of opens splits, you know, every 6 inches, I think. Don't hold me to that, but with a laser space, and it cuts a straight slice, you know, on a wave filter, and, you know, if it rains, it takes in the nutrients and the rain. Instead of the rain running off, it helps it penetrate the ground and go in and takes the nutrients and all from chicken manure also down in instead of running across the land. So in the fall, we use it to incorporate our cover crops to work it in the ground just slightly so that it just start growing and come up. So it's keeps the soil structure there, and then keeps all your residue on top. Chops it up a little bit to make it start breaking down and converting into nutrients, but it doesn't remove it. So it still protects the soil and keeps it there from the wind and rain.
So, I was thinking about that technology and doing a little bit of looking at it a little bit. The question I was wondering about was, I mean, it seems like an important technology in terms of the land and also controlling runoff. But the question is, How widespread is this technology across the shore, and is it, and realistically, do you think they can replace traditional method of spreading manure? Because some folks argue it's very expensive, and most farmers, 90% of the farmers, some people would argue a large number of farmers couldn't afford to do it.
Well, you still, as far as terms of manure, you still spread your manure the same way, and then you have to make this extra pass with this tillage tool to work it in, but. Now there's new technology, this Knifer rig, and that's going to be a major problem because
what's it called?
It's a rig that actually knifes the manure in. It incorporates chicken manure right, like knifes it into the ground as you're applying it. And the problem with that is you can't do very many acres in a day, like very few acres in a day's time with this new machine. It's a very expensive machine. It's not that we're against using it; it's just economically feasible for us to use. So we've gone this other route of spreading the manure on and then using what's called a turbo-till device. Or there's other what they call vertical tillage equipment out there. Turbo-till was the first one out, I guess, one of the first ones with the names kind of taken on. But my point is it's still an expensive piece. So larger farmers are able to purchase that device and incorporate the manure. It covers a lot of ground quickly so that we can get the job done, especially with the short, you know, if it's a rainy season like it's been this year, we've had very little window to get it done. The problem is if you're a smaller farmer, say, a few hundred acres, you can't afford a $50,000 piece of equipment to go out there and do 300 acres, especially you're probably not even applying manure to all 300 acres because soybeans you don't apply. So it's not just viable. So what some of them have had to go out there is with a disc and incorporate it. Well, that getting back, that destroys no-till. So you've done a negative thing to make a positive thing. So the question is what balances out? I mean, is that better to disc it in and leave it on top? Because now you destroyed your residue on top and buried it under soil. Because you can't, it's very difficult to lightly disc and incorporate and not destroy it and still have a good seedbed. It makes it very rough if you try to do it too little. So that's some of the arguments we've had with these new regulations. You know, they want us to incorporate it. I understand their point, but at the cost of our no-till would not be good. But the larger farmers are able to adapt. The smaller farmers are actually the ones that are getting penalized more because they can't afford that equipment to incorporate it. So they refer back to a disc, you know, the old way, conventional tillage, and have to work it in. So then now we've destroyed no-till. It's mad if it's been somebody in the field for 10, 20 years, you know, because the soil quality is much better when it's no-till and better for the environment. You know, your earthworms are there. You're not destroying the earthworms and organisms that are good for it, the soil and the environment. So, you know, it's a toss-up, and, you know, where, depending on how many acres, which way it goes, you know, it may be okay or it may not. You know, it might be causing more problems, especially on those particular farms.
Kathy Phillips, the Assateague Coast Keeper.
Look, in one of those articles, Lee Richardson spoke about the new technology that agriculture is using here on Delmarva. And he talks about the new machinery that injects, it's a subsurface injector that instead of spreading the manure on top of the ground where it can flow away or wash away with stormwater runoff, it's worked into the soil immediately. That's great, but you know what? They've got one or two of these machines, and they're pretty much just used for show and tell. I mean, they may be used on one farm, but for 90%, 99% of the Eastern Shore, you're going to see the old, you know, same old manure spreaders just spreading everything on the soil, and then within a day, 2 days, sometimes even a week later, they finally have the ability to get back and till it into the ground. That's what's happening, you know, for the most part down here. So, you know, can we take a look at things and see if there's a better way? It would be great if every crop grower was using this new technology, but it's expensive and not everybody can afford it. Maybe there's a way that if the industry got a little more involved financially with dealing with their waste stream down here, maybe every crop grower could have a subsurface injector, and we wouldn't be aerially, you know, over top of the ground spreading manure. We've got to sit down and figure out what to do about phosphorus down here. And yes, there's plenty of studies that are going on, and there's possibly new state regulations that may be coming in about it, but the emphasis is always talking about nitrogen, and we've got to talk more about phosphorus. So, you know, there's a lot of things that could be done if we could just move past the rhetoric and, you know, everybody just stop pointing fingers at everybody else, that it's not our problem, it's the city's problem. And, you know, let's just deal with this one aspect and find the best way to regulate this industry that is not overburdensome, Quite frankly, you know, the amount of regulation that is on agriculture right now is so much less than, say, wastewater treatment plants or municipal stormwater. You know, it's they're not overregulated at this point, and we just have to find a better way of managing these regulations so that they actually have accomplish the pollution reductions that they're supposed to accomplish.
Well, Kath Phillips, this has been, you've given us a great deal of information. I appreciate all the time. Thank you so much for the work you're doing, for joining us today. Kath Phillips is the ST Coast Keeper and on the water advocate who patrols and protects Maryland and Northern Virginia Eastern Shore coastal bays. Kathy, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mark, as always. Great talking to you.
We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we return, we'll hear more about how agricultural and environmental regulation affects the economy and ecology of Delmarva. From Dave Wilson, who's the executive director of the Maryland Coastal Bays Program. Then we'll talk about new laws called either Farm Animal Protection Acts or Ag-Gag Laws, depending on who you ask. What they do effectively is to criminalize whistleblowing at CAFOs and slaughterhouses. The question being debated is whether these laws stifle journalists trying to expose cruel conditions, and do they step all over the First Amendment, or are they necessary to protect farmers from people who want to shut them down? We'll be joined by environmental reporter Will Potter and Emily Meredith, communications director for the Animal Agricultural Alliance. Welcome back to Soundbites. I'm Mark Steiner, and today on the program we're discussing the article Elaine Bean wrote for DelmarvaNow.com about agricultural regulations and their impact on Worcester County. Today we're asking environmentalists, farmers, and public officials who were in the article about how agricultural and environmental laws in Maryland affect the economy and ecology of the Eastern Shore. And next up, we have Dave Wilson. Dave Wilson is the executive director of Maryland Coastal Bays Program. And Dave Wilson, welcome to Soundbites.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
Dave, let's just start very quickly. Give our listeners a very quick overview of what the Maryland Coastal Bays Program is. Let's start there.
Sure, yeah. The program is a nonprofit, although it's funded through 320 money, which comes through the Environmental Protection Agency. And so we're funded through the Clean Water Act, and we have 10 full-time staff and a number of part-time staff who do conservation projects in the Coastal Bays watershed and work with recreational commercial fishermen and farmers and others to come up with sort of the common sense solutions that we think we can all agree on to protect the Coastal Bays watershed here in Maryland.
Well, what is common sense solution? People use that word a lot. What does that mean?
Yeah, no, well, common sense, I guess, in this case, I mean, things that are practical for folks. And again, what is practical for one person may not be practical for another. We certainly see the need for regulations, but we also, you know, we've had a lot of success, I think, from our program standpoint of changing a lot of minds. You know, I've been here 15 years. I've seen a lot of opinions change. I've seen a lot of attitudes change. And part of the idea of working to reach common ground, I think, one of the benefits of that is really the attitude change that we've seen in our partners and people we work with who you wouldn't normally would think would be amenable to a lot of conservation initiatives that we were promoting.
I'm going to come back to this question of common sense, but one of the things you were quoted as saying in the article in DelMarva.com is that you said, I think that what you're basically saying is that you think that ag buffers are working, we're just not seeing it. We're not going to see it for years to come. So that's an interesting position. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, we you know, in the Coastal Bays watershed, is we sort of think of the Coastal Bays as northern, southern coastal bays, and the southern coastal bays we have almost no growth. We have really good zoning in Worcester County, and so the southern coastal bays we've seen this gradual increase in nutrients, increasing every year. We've lost some seagrasses, almost half of our seagrasses in 2005, which have struggled to recover. We've seen lower dissolved oxygen levels, and so we give out a little more than $100,000 a year for research. We sort of worked with the University of Maryland and others to kind of figure out what is going on, and what we found was that you know, a lot of the issue is old groundwater. I mean, this is groundwater that's 10, 15 years old that is finally making its way to Chincoteague Bay. And all that groundwater, of course, has none of the, you know, when poultry first started here on the shore, there weren't a lot of the vegetated buffers and WRP, which is a wetlands program, and a lot of the good things that sort of happened since the you know, 1980s. And so, you know, what we see is that we have some really old historic groundwater inputs that are going to take years to sort of make their way through. And with that, of course, it's going to take us a long time to see the progress that we made with buffers and all the really good stuff that we've done in Chincoteague Bay with buffers and wetlands, which is by far the watershed that's had the most work done. But it's odd to see it sort of decline the most when we have all these really good ag buffers and things in that particular watershed.
So are you saying you think the job is done then? We've just not seen it? Or do you think there's a lot more to do?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot more to do. I mean, we still know that agriculture is producing the most nutrients. They're putting the most nutrients into the system. You know, we've done, you know, a lot with vegetated buffers, both through the state programs, but also through the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Of course, the heavy use paths, you know, manure sheds, composters, things like that, they're going to take a while to see the benefits of those things. You can sort of liken it to climate change. I mean, the nutrients are in the system, just like carbon dioxide's in the air. I mean, it's going to take a while for these things to really show the benefits of a lot of this work that's been going on for the past, you know, decade or so.
Is your sense that there are too many regulations? A lot of farmers thinking there are too many regulations, that all we do is just paperwork, and that we're the most overregulated state in America when it comes to farming. Is that the case? The regulations, the right regulations, the wrong ones?
No, I have to say that, you know, I think a lot of the regulations are good. Sometimes it's just how they're applied. I think the laws themselves and the ideas behind the reduction in those laws are quite good in many ways. In most of those laws, now we can't want to cherry pick law by law, but in general, I think Maryland has shown a lot of common sense in some of the laws, and I think, you know, if we can get the paperwork down in such a way that, number one, people will get used to it, but also have it done in such a way that, remember, you know, this is a farming community. These aren't people who are running, you know, large businesses that have secretaries that can do this work. Sometimes I think the state legislature forgets that, and I think there's sort of a common ground in terms of how the paperwork is done and how it's applied versus the law itself, which are generally good laws. It's just the application that can be a little onerous sometimes with the paperwork.
Well, Dave Wilson, I look forward to having you back here on Soundbites real soon. Dave Wilson.
I look forward to it.
Me too. Dave Wilson is Executive Director of the Maryland Coastal Bays Program, as we are bringing the sound of the article written in DeMarvaNow.com, regulated chicken growing is a tough business, to life here on Soundbites. Thank you so much, Dave.
My pleasure.
And now we're going to switch gears. We're about to talk to Will Potter. He's a journalist who focuses on animal rights, environmental movements, civil liberties issues, and his book is Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. And before we bring him right in here, reminding you that this is a conversation about what some people call farm protection legislation or ag gag bills. And we'll talk about what that means, but let's harken back and think about what it means in the context of our history. In 1906, there was a book written that just took America apart in many ways, called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. It was so heavy, so brilliant, that it caused a transformation of an industry, of people in the meatpacking industry, an amazingly powerful book. We are joined now, more than 100 years later, talking about not allowing those kind of things to happen anymore. And Will Potter, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Will, to talk a bit about this, what people are arguing about in terms of what this means. Some people who are opposed to this, who support this legislation, are calling it farm protection legislation. Those who oppose it have been calling it euphemistically as the ag gag bill. So what are we talking about?
We're talking about a wave of legislation that's been introduced around the country decades ago, but we saw a recent wave last year. And now we have multiple states considering new laws that are so broad that they criminalize anyone who takes photographs or videotape of what happens on factory farms and slaughterhouses. some of these new bills go a little bit further and aren't even confined to animal agriculture. They include every industry. For example, the new bill being considered in North Carolina includes all of manufacturing, and a similar bill was in Indiana. So what we're really talking about are attempts by corporations and entire industries to silence whistleblowers and to keep consumers in the dark about practices that we found objectionable and that people are upset about.
So you're talking about places like North Carolina, which is a huge center for some very large, what people call industrial farms, especially in the pig industry, and Indiana, these are not just limited to farms, but all of industry?
That's right. And I think this is really a response to the widespread public backlash against these ag gag bills. I mean, people have been really up in arms around the country at the thought of being closed out from information about what actually happens on these farms. Now, it's important for your listeners to understand that this is all in the context of really a wave of undercover investigations that have not only shown egregious animal welfare violations, but for instance, in California, an undercover investigation led to the largest meat recall in U.S. history because of public health concerns. Similarly, we have unions like the AFL-CIO and the Teamsters fighting this legislation because it really puts workers at risk. So when we see stuff like this happening in North Carolina, it's really taking bills that are already incredibly broad and making them even broader and apply to all industries.
So now, tell me what effect this has had already, if it has had any effect at all from your work that you've seen.
Well, I think the most immediate effect is actually not at all what the industry intended. I mean, it's created a national dialogue about these issues, not just about the legislation, but about why that legislation has been introduced by these industries. You know, people are talking about animal welfare issues on these farms and on these slaughterhouses. They're talking about the environmental concerns, the workers' rights concerns. I mean, it's really brought all of these different groups and organizations and issue areas under the same umbrella. So I think that, to me, is the most important consequence so far. But in terms of the immediate impact on undercover investigators and whistleblowers, I still think it's a little too early to tell. The first bills passed last session in Utah, Iowa, and Missouri. And in that time, you know, animal welfare groups have said that they're not able to do investigations in those states anymore. And I think we might see the pattern of that, of groups having to shy away from things like this because they're afraid of prosecution.
Well, are people shying away from doing it, or are people kind of as journalists going ahead and doing their investigations when they think they're necessary and then dealing with the consequences after they do it?
I think it's going to certainly be more of the latter. I mean, in my experience reporting on these issues, the one thing I've found is that as legislation like this is introduced in an attempt to silence political activists and whistleblowers and journalists, it usually leads to a backlash because people don't like being told what not to look at or what not to talk about. And I think there's clearly a commitment from the unions, from workers, from investigators and whistleblowers to keep exposing these abuses.
There are a couple of things, though. I mean, that I'm curious where you think these investigations have already shown their effectiveness.
We've seen it around the country. I mean, the California example I gave, I think, is a really important one.
Uh-huh.
But another one in Wyoming, for instance, shown workers slamming piglets into concrete floors. In North Carolina, an investigation of a butterball facility showed workers beating turkeys, hitting them with metal pipes, swinging them by their necks and their wings. I mean, really egregious stuff. And it actually led to the first criminal felony prosecution of people for animal welfare abuse against birds, against poultry on these farms in history. So, I mean, we're really seeing a complete shift within law enforcement and within the media about how these issues are being regarded.
So, of course, the industry would say that that even when you find things like this, these are things that are anomalies. These are not part of overall practice. That we have an industry that self-regulates and is regulated, and that this swath of looking at animal cruelty makes it appear as if this is an industry-wide phenomenon when it's not.
Well, I think most people would be really shocked to learn that there is not a single law that protects animals on these farms during their lives. Not one. So when the industry says things like this, they're really talking about self-policing. And I think we should all consider whether the largest industries in the country, and in some cases in the world, should be responsible for self-policing themselves when public health, environmental issues, and animal welfare are on the line. I mean, when we see these types of abuses on factory farms and slaughterhouses, in some cases, I think they can be treated as aberrations. I mean, things like what I was talking about in North Carolina. In other instances, though, what these undercover investigators are showing are really standard industry practices. There are things like gestation crates, which keep female pigs confined their entire lives without being able to move around, battery cages, standard de-beaking and tail docking procedures. I mean, things that are normal in the industry, and I think that's really what these investigations are about as well.
So a couple of quick things here. One is when people make this critique, and say these bills are outlandish and shouldn't be allowed to happen, the ag-gag bills, as they're being called, that there's people in the industry, many people, and some of the people listening to this broadcast who are in that industry now in our countryside, in our rural areas, are saying, look, these are a bunch of folks who are vegans and anti-meat eaters, and they're just trying to shut us down.
Well, it's simply not true. I mean, if you look at the coalition that's fighting these bills, it includes journalism groups, First Amendment organizations, the ACLU, the Teamsters, the AFL-CIO, even the National Association of Prosecutors, which is, you know, not known as being a liberal, lefty, animal rights extremist group. I mean, this has really brought together an incredibly diverse coalition that don't see eye to eye on most things and are most certainly not animal rights groups are sympathetic even to those issues, to fight these bills on First Amendment grounds and on consumer grounds.
And well, as we wind up here, what is your website?
GreenIsTheNewRed.com.
And so we've been talking to Will Potter. He wrote the book, Green is the New Red, an insider's account of social movements under siege, talking about ag-gag bills, others are calling farm protection legislation. And Will Potter, thank you so much, and we will link to your work on our website. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I appreciate it.
We're about to talk to Emily Meredith. She is Communications Director for the Animal Agricultural Alliance. And Emily, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell me very quickly first, what is this other AAA that you were part of?
Well, we are the Animal Agriculture Alliance. We were founded in 1987, so we're celebrating our 26th year. And we are basically represent everyone from farm to fork in the food chain. So we represent individual farmers and ranchers, veterinarians, packer processors, all the national associations in the Beltway. They're all members of ours. And then all the way up to big corporations that produce food. And so we like to say everyone farm to fork. And we communicate with media and consumers about issues that are affecting, you know, this group of individuals and also issues that are affecting consumers with regards to animal agriculture and their milk, meat, and egg products in this country.
So now we've been talking a bit about these things that are called, on one hand, some people call them farm protection legislation, which I think that's what you call them. Other groups call them the ag gag bills that would limit the ability to film on farms and slaughterhouses, documenting what some call as animal abuse across the country. 5 states, Missouri, Utah, Iowa, including those states have outlawed the practice. North Carolina is the newest state to consider a law. Other states, Arkansas, California, Indiana, Nebraska, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and Vermont, are thinking about these things as well. And it's been associated, some people say, with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And other people would argue that this just doesn't, some people argue it would protect farms. Other people are arguing that what this is doing is really criminalizing filming of any farm and slaughterhouses. That anyway, let's stop there. What's your take on what this would do?
Well, I mean, that of course is a lot of questions, but all at once. However, I will say first and foremost that the bill that was considered last year in Iowa was actually introduced by Representative Annette Sweeney. And the bill was written around her kitchen table. She is a rancher. She raises cattle. and she was approached by other farm families who were looking for a recourse because these videos are disingenuous in nature. And not only are they misrepresentative of the industry as a whole, but they also are deceptive and manipulative in the actual footage that is being shown to the mass public. And so these farm families approached Representative Sweeney and said, you know, what's our recourse? You know, we don't have millions of dollars to go into litigation against these activist groups that are producing these videos, so we need some other measures in place. And so Representative Sweeney got together with other legislators in Iowa and said, you know, and came up with this bill. And the bill in Iowa has actually been taken and spun off, and a lot of states are considering those measures this year. And so Alec, you know, I think is taking the blame or the credit, whichever, depending on your political bend, and they really had nothing to do with it. And the impetus was really coming from farm families that are looking for a recourse against groups that are really seeking to end their way of life and their family businesses.
So let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, when we talk about any way of life, I mean, some people would argue that from the people who do this kind of work, this kind of filming, that as they harken back to 107 years ago when Upton Sinclair put The Jungle out, and the books that kind of changed the landscape by forcing slaughterhouses to change their practices. This would kind of make even that illegal, and that what this is exposed, for the most part, have been real abuses that have taken place and not things that have not been abuses that have forced some changes. So why is that a problem when, in fact, most farmers that I've ever known or interviewed don't do this kind of abuse, but this kind of opens sheds light on those who do?
Well, I mean, I don't think anyone in the entire industry, you know, condones abuse. Not only is it first and foremost bad for business, but second of all, it goes against how, like you just said, you know, how these farmers who have been doing this for generations, it goes against how they're raised. You know, they were raised with fundamental respect for the animals they're raising. But then you enter into the mix that these groups that really want a vegan world, you know, the leaders of these groups have been quoted repeatedly saying that there is nothing more important than promoting veganism, that they seek a vegan world, that they want to end the consumption of meat, milk, and eggs. So you're introducing those people into the mix, and so it's fundamentally, there's a discord there, because what are you seeking to accomplish ultimately? On the one hand, they're saying that they are just out for improving animal welfare and improving processes, but then on the other hand, they're saying that they promote a vegan world. And for a lot of the industry, myself included, it doesn't seem like those two go together. And so if, in my mind, you truly cared about protecting animal, you know, animal welfare and safeguarding that, you wouldn't be recording footage for 3 months at a time and not reporting legitimate instances of abuse that you are seeing. Instead, you'd be seeing it, you'd be saying something, and you'd be putting an end to the abuse immediately. You wouldn't be waiting to release that video at a time that's, you know, politically conceived or, you know, strategically opportune for you and your organization, you'd be reporting that abuse immediately. So I think there's a lot of ulterior motives for these groups, and so I think those motives are really at the heart of this issue and why this legislation is so important.
So some of the people I've interviewed about this, I mean, you're saying that it's a vegan enterprise. Most people I've interviewed are not vegans. They're photojournalists, and some of the major kind of news organizations in the country are kind of opposing these laws, that they're not pushing a vegan agenda. They're just pushing an agenda to make sure that that abuses don't take place on the animals that we eat.
I mean, the videos that are coming out, I mean, I haven't been seeing a lot that are not being funded in large part or in total by activist groups, including the Humane Society, Mercy for Animals, Compassion Over Killing, and PETA. And so I think that the journalists that are kind of piggybacking on this issue and making it about free speech or whatever the case may be, I think that they're kind of piggybacking on a hot topic right now, when in reality the videos and the legislation that is safeguarding against videos like this being introduced is really directed at activist groups who have an agenda that's, you know, diametrically opposed to the industry, one that seeks to end the industry. And so I think that There's a lot of hullabaloo over this right now because it's a very hot topic and it's very sexy, and it's great for people to piggyback on that and promote their own book sales or whatever the case may be. But really, the videos that are being seen and that have been seen and that are presenting issues for these farm families are the videos that are, you know, being promoted and funded by these activist groups. And I think on the other side, too, if you truly want to do, really want to see a farm or a ranch or a processing facility in action, there's been a lot of videos that have been produced with, you know, the owner's consent, the farm family's consent. You know, Oprah Winfrey did a great one a few years ago. The American Meat Institute does videos all the time in various slaughterhouse facilities. And so I think that there are ways to do that and still get your story. And if you approach it in a, you know, truthful and factual manner, there are every farmer I've ever met would like to open the doors. They have nothing to hide. So, you know, just approach it and give your true purpose. And that's not what these activist groups are doing. They're hiding their true identity. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I finished what you're saying, Emily. I apologize. Go ahead.
I was just going to say they're hiding their true identities. They're coming on to these, you know, farms and ranches, and they really, again, have this deceptive and manipulative and underhanded purpose.
But the other part of that, the other side, would kind of argue that, look, that you, if you're going to do any serious investigative reporting about not necessarily farms, but especially in the slaughterhouse industry, that which is, some people argue, one of the least regulated industries in America, right now, that the only way you can do it is to go undercover. Anybody's going to let you in. They're going to let you in and show you the best. But if you have word that somebody is doing something that is against animal welfare, against our right to eat meat that hasn't been tainted, because I'm not a vegan, there's not been tainted, that the only way you can do it is to go undercover. And what that does is make illegal free journalism in America.
I mean, again, I disagree. And I think that the FDA and the USDA Food Safety Inspection Service would disagree that slaughterhouses are the least regulated industry in the country. You know, there's inspectors on site every day. Anytime you're slaughtering, there's inspectors there. So I think that they would probably take issue with that statement. I think that, again, that just goes to all the misconceptions that are out there about the industry as a whole. And I think, you know, unfortunately, the people I work for and the people I represent, you know, these are people that are up before I'm even awake in the morning, caring for the animals and running their businesses. And so they haven't always been the most communicative. And I think that right now that's hurting the industry because they have this long history of just taking pride in their work and keeping their head down and doing their job. And so now the industry has kind of has recognized that it is important to communicate to consumers and is important to get out there and share their stories, share what they're doing, and talk to consumers about the issues that matter to them day in and day out and how they raise food in this country. And I'm glad you're not a vegan, and hopefully you're having a big steak tonight. So,
well, Emily Meredith, Communications Director for the Animal Agricultural Alliance, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's all we have time for today on Soundbites. And I'd like to thank all of our guests, Kathy Phillips, Royden Powell III, Lee Richardson, Dave Wilson, Will Potter, and Emily Meredith. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.